Plenty of news coming out of UFC 78 this weekend and across the entire MMA world. So we've invited back our good friend Luke Thomas from BloodyElbow.com, one of the best MMA sites on the World Wide Web. And Luke, we'll get right to it. First off, this Friday night in San Jose was a big Strikeforce event, one of the first MMA tournaments we've seen in North America in a long time. And the big news coming out of that card was that it seems as though local favorites Kung Lee and Frank Shamrock are going to be facing each other in 2008. What do you think about that matchup?
I wouldn't bet that it's going to happen right away. They both verbally agreed to fight one another, but I think that was in large part due to the fact that there was a crowd there in attendance, and it's an interesting matchup, and it's been sort of rumored for many, many weeks now that would be a good fight to, and that there's a bit of bad blood brewing between Lee and Shamrock. As for it actually happening, I don't know. First of all, Frank Shamrock has expressed an interest to rematch Renzo Gracie. So he lost to him on the debut of Elite XC, and I think he's looking to get that that bad loss, the bad taste in his mouth for disqualification out of his mouth. But beyond that, it's not clear what's next for Lee. Lee said after the fight that, if they make it happen, it'll happen. If not, then he's sort of glad to be competing again. That there's anything signed or anything official about it, I think it's really premature at this date.
So you don't believe that their next respective fights will be against each other?
No, I don't. I don't. I think Frank Shamrock was much more interested in avenging a loss to Renzo than he is in fighting Lee. I don't personally think that Frank Shamrock thinks Lee has much for him once the fight hits the floor. And I think that Renzo loss was really something. His reaction and since that fight has been a very unexpected reaction, because I don't think he, as little as he cares about the opinions of others, I think he was susceptible to some of the criticism that he didn't look his best, and Renzo was positionally winning that fight, and then it kind of bothered him a little bit. And I would suspect that because there's nothing official, that was a little bit more showmanship than anything actually on paper that what you saw between Kung Lee and Frank Shamrock.
What do you make of Kung Lee? There's a lot of hype surrounding him. He seems to be this kind of throwback Bruce Lee type of character. And, his last couple of fights, he did score victories, but not exactly the most impressive victories out there. What do you make of him and his potential to actually be a legitimate star in the world of mixed martial arts?
Well, folks who don't know about Kung Lee's background, he's actually a pretty novel guy. He was sort of like the greatest. He was the Fedor of this Chinese style of kickboxing called Sanxiao, however you want to pronounce it, which basically is in many ways similar to regular kickboxing that you see. A little bit more of the sort of flashy Taekwondo dynamic strikes, but there's also takedowns involved. There's no ground fighting per se, but there are takedowns, a lot of throws, a lot of hip tosses, a lot of suplexes, if you can believe that, belly to belly. German suplexes and whatnot. So it's very interesting style of kickboxing. So that's sort of almost like two-thirds of what you need in MMA. Not really, but kind of, sort of. And so the question is, how does his ground game come along? I know that he's at least a blue belt level with the gi on. I would suspect he's probably a little bit better than that. Is that enough to hang in MMA? With most guys, I think it is. Clearly on the feet, he has a skill set that if not, well, I think it's certainly polished, but it's even more than that. It's a very unorthodox, crescent kicks. His timing is off. But, it's not a typical kind of wrestler who learned how to box and kickbox. This is a much different kind of, obviously a very athletic guy, explosive power. So the question still only remains really about his ground. I don't know that he's the best MMA striker out there, but he's certainly a competent one. And given his skill set, like Carl Parisian, always poses a problem, I think, even for tough guys. But I would say that based on what I know about Frank Shamrock and based on what I know about Kung Lee, and again, Kung Lee is still a bit of an unknown commodity, Frank Shamrock should wipe the floor with him once it hits the mat.
And a few months ago, there seemed to have been some rumors that Frank Shamrock was going to fight Ken Shamrock, a match that I guess a lot of people maybe 10 years ago would have been really interested in seeing. And now both guys are moving up there in the age in their ages. So A, do fans really care to see these two guys fight? And if they would, who would you favor?
Oh, it's weird. When two brothers fight each other, you have to kind of expect that there's going to be, even though they're not biologically related, you have to expect that there's going to be all out war. But I would be shocked if Ken Shamrock beat Frank Shamrock. As big as he is, as strong as he is, I would find that very difficult to believe. I don't know that Ken Shamrock at the age he is has got a whole lot for his brother. And I think that match, you're right. I mean, maybe 5 to 10 years ago would have been more compelling, but in many ways, Shamrock versus Shamrock is such a manufactured yet compelling storyline that even now that could sell a lot of pay-per-views, provided the rest of the card had some decent padding. I mean, let's say that Elite XC did the Shamrock versus Frank Shamrock main event, and then threw a Kimbo Slice video fight on there as well. I mean, that seems to me something they could really could sell. So I would say that when people clamor for a Kung Lee Frank Shamrock kind of match, I think fans need to be aware of their own bias. Fans more often than not, at least nowadays it seems, they want matchups that are interesting and compelling, obviously, but they want very meaningful matchups. There's so many different organizations, and MMA is so splintered. I think fans are kind of clamoring for promoters to kind of hammer out what the landscape actually looks like underneath the surface of advertising and marketing and the Ultimate Fighter. So, if you see a Shamrock versus Shamrock, great. That's not a whole lot meaningful. Kung Lee versus Frank Shamrock is more meaningful, but again, it's not clear that Frank Shamrock is really invested in proving who he is, provided he believes that he's already the greatest alive at 185 pounds.
All right, and the big news coming out of the other big news coming out of that show was in the 185 weight bracket, the tournament, the four-man tournament that Strikeforce put on, won by Jorge Santiago. There were injuries, there were rumors of other guys being involved in it. Finally, we had our four guys, and Sean Salmon stepped in at the last minute as an injury replacement. And I mean, once again, another highlight reel knockout Salmon puts up there, and actually suffered an apparent seizure in the middle of the cage and now seems to be okay. Do you think that Sean Salmon should fight again? I mean, the California State Athletic Commission said that they're going to review this and see if he should be, sanctioned to fight again. What are your thoughts on Sean?
Well, obviously you have to err on the side of caution. So I would say that in the short term, because he's been taking fights on rather quick notices, like, for example, I think he has another fight coming up, or he was supposed to have another fight coming up on HD Net against Mayhem Miller. I would say that for his own caution, that may be something that he should not consider doing at this point in time. That being said, I don't put a whole lot of stock in what any athletic commission has to say, and that sounds kind of strange because if you want to support MMA, you have to support the idea of government regulation. You have to support the idea that these people, the law is going to be the last line of defense against barbarism, and it's going to raise the level of overall medical concern and professionalism so that you can regulate this activity in a way that is meaningful and helpful and makes sense. That being said, I don't know what qualifies Armando Garcia to say if someone did or did not have a seizure. Maybe the in-ring doctor told him that. Maybe that doctor is quite mistaken. In fact, Salmon and his agent Ken Pavia went on as much to say that he actually didn't have a seizure. Do I believe an agent over a doctor provided that's the discrepancy? Generally not. I found Ken Pavia's defense of his client Phil Baroni with regards to steroids downright laughable. But that's neither here nor there. I would say that at the end of the day, though, those two knockouts, if nothing about his medical situation, and I think we need to wait for more details to come out about that, it certainly, for the image-wise, I think that's the real beating he took there. Sean Salmon, unfortunately, is actually a very good fighter. He is going to be associated with stretchers and neck braces, and that's kind of the way it goes. I mean, if you're talking about two devastating knockouts. I mean, truly, he took two highly, low percentage but highly effective shots flush, captured on film in HD both times. That's just a bad spot to be in as a fighter. The whole point of him competing so much and getting a lot of experience recently was to wash that bad taste out of his mouth from the Evans knockout. And then out of nowhere, Jorge Santiago, a guy known for getting knocked out like that himself, was the one who did it. Jorge Santiago got knocked out by Manuel Gambarian, the guy who was the runner-up in T-Season 5, the Ultimate Fighter, knocked out clean by that guy. And so to lose to him, I think, Salmon, I mean, that's got to be devastating for your personal life, and it's going to be devastating for your career image. I think that's the repair work that if he wants to get back in the ring, he needs to be concerned with.
And what do you make of this whole tournament? Because as we spoke of earlier, of Frank Shamrock and Kung Lee, those seem to be the top dogs in 185 in Strikeforce. And it doesn't really appear as though Jorge Santiago is going to even get a title shot anytime soon or even get to face one of those guys. His name is not brought up in any of the discussions. So really, other than the fact to say that they were able to put on this tournament for the first time in X amount of years and all that and kind of harken back to the old Pride Grand Prix days, well, what was the point of the whole thing?
Yeah, but the other side of the equation, I hear what you're saying, but the other side of the equation is, do we really take the Strikeforce middleweight division, quote-unquote, seriously? are we trying to build another division outside of the UFC? I mean, maybe that makes me kind of a UFC fan in a way that I don't intend, but I'm not at this point. I am far less concerned with Strikeforce's divisions insofar as, when I say division, I don't mean the actual categorical demarcation. I mean the roster fighters who build that inside of that category. And unless they have 100 guys in the middleweight division, I'm not so keen on figuring out who is number five versus number four in the Strikeforce 185 pound class. That to me doesn't really mean a difference. What means, what's more meaningful to me is either interesting or meaningful matchups. And so, is Santiago, should he get a title shot? I mean, sure, but what does that really mean? And he's the best in Strikeforce. Well, Strikeforce only has a handful of guys, so it's a great achievement insofar as he's beating up those guys. But I don't know that we should be so concerned with linear title shots and this guy beat that guy. He should be ranked higher when they're in peripheral or these secondary organizations. I don't know if that's the most immediate push. Although I would say, surprisingly, that's a huge win for Jorge Santiago. That's a major, major win. I had totally thought that Trevor Pranley was going to win. Pranley could have been good account himself in his first fight, but apparently Santiago took it to him in the second. Santiago's not a guy with a very good chin, good jiu-jitsu. A match with him and Kung Lee would be interesting, provided Santiago take it to the ground, but I doubt that would happen. So, huge win for him. But again, I mean, where does that put him? He lost twice in the UFC, so hard to say that this is really a rankings-changing kind of fight.
All right, so then I guess, their strategy worked because people were talking about it and it just presented a great night of fights. So let's move on to UFC 78, Saturday night in Newark. And last week when we had you on, you weren't that excited about this one. You're not the only one, or you weren't the only one. And I guess depending on who you talk to, the show kind of came out as expected. There were a few highlights here, but overall quite lackluster. And I'm sure Dana White will have his spin on how great the night was, but let's be real, Rashad Evans is not in the top five coming off that win, and maybe Thiago Silva moved up into the top 10, but I guess that's questionable on itself. We'll get to him in a second. First off, Bisping Evans. There seems to be some talk that Bisping should have won the fight. Obviously, I would disagree with that. I actually had Evans winning maybe all three rounds. What were your impressions on the fight? And, would you now consider Rashad Evans a top five light heavyweight contender in the UFC?
No. Maybe he put himself back into the top 10. I mean, I don't know when over Michael Bisping does that for you per se, but, Evans, this was not Evans' best performance, and it looks like even on his days where he doesn't give his best performance, he gives enough to win over top, or, relatively top guys. That says a lot. I mean, I think people aren't giving Evans enough credit. Yeah, he didn't look his best. I expected him to come out and just absolutely slam the bejesus out of Bisping. It didn't happen. Bisping made a much better account of himself. He said he overtrained for the Hamill fight. Looks like he hit this training period. He peaked at the right time. Good for him. Bisping, terribly unimpressive. I think the general consensus is that if you look at CompuStrike data, it turns out that maybe Bisping landed more shots, including power shots, in the third round. But those are always helpful guides to judging. And the fact of the matter is, he didn't do enough in the third round. Bisping just simply did not. He could have. The opportunity was open. And the reason why people are sort of sour on it is that he kind of let the opportunity pass and by default kind of gave the fight to Evans. But whose fault is that? Evans' fault? This is Bisping's fault. Bisping needs to be in the middleweight division. He's not big enough for those guys. He doesn't have the wrestling acumen to really handle a lot of the elite wrestlers in that division. There's a lot of open space in the middleweight division. Obviously, Anderson Silva at the top of the hill, that kind of makes it kind of hard, but nevertheless, it's a much better weight class for him. But as far as the rankings, if anybody moved up, it was Evans, and even then, the most important thing that you learn from watching that is that categorically, Rampage is a better fighter. He's not just a champion. He is categorically on a different level than the Michael Bispings and the Rashad Evanses of the lightweight division. And so I think they know that. The UFC knows that. But you can't, there's a rule with Dana White. He's going to sell, the more he tries to convince you a card is good, the more it sucks. Because fights that are great, he'll tell you at once, and then he'll move on to something else, or, the storylines about it. He doesn't harp on that, but he doesn't actually make the marketing pitch, this fight is great. And it was clear it was a mediocre event, and it was a mediocre fight, and it didn't prove a whole lot, and I think we should have seen that going into it, and here we are now.
Now, do you foresee Michael Bisping actually moving down to 185 coming up on his next fight?
I certainly hope so. He needs to. If he doesn't, he's in trouble. And where's he going to go? Who's he going to move up on? He can't even be the guy named Rashad Evans, who is maybe or maybe not top 10. Well, let's assume he's number 11. There are 10 guys, ostensibly, more prepared at this juncture to beat Michael Bisping. I mean, that's a pretty far place to be in versus 185, which he could be a lot bigger at, probably even keep all the same speed and maybe as much as the strength, and fight guys who are a little bit, a little easier to deal with, not in terms of skill level per se, but because size is a huge difference. People don't understand how different. Go train, if you're 150 pounds, go train with somebody who's 200. Yeah, it's a 50-pound weight difference, but what's 50 pounds? 50 pounds is a fight-changing amount of weight. At the professional level, 20 pounds is a fight-ending, fight-changing amount of weight. It matters. It really, really, that's why they do everything down to a science. At the professional level, every element of a fight game is down to the science, the eating, the drinking, the training, the running, the lifting, the jiu-jitsu, everything is down. And when it's not, and when there's something out of whack, you're going to get results that are not maximized. He's not maximizing his potential at 205 pounds. He's doing well, and he's doing good, but he's not maximizing his potential. And I don't know that any fighter who has that kind of ability wants to just simply coast. So, yes, I think if he has any sense, he's rumored about it. He knows he can do, he can make the weight. I think eventually pressure will force him in that direction.
Now, I was actually present at the Prudential Center on Saturday, and I must admit the roar when Houston Alexander came out rivaled anyone else on the card, including hometown boy Frankie Edgar. And the build-up to Alexander, you know, the promos that were aired throughout the night, they really seemed to zone in on trying to build him up into a star. And, you know, unlike in the professional wrestling world, you can kind of control these things. Unfortunately, things did not work out that well for Alexander. And a lot of people were saying, you know, we've yet to see him on the ground. We've yet to see his jiu-jitsu skills. And apparently he doesn't have many. Do you think that Joe Silva and company kind of dropped the ball on this one? Obviously two great guys, great fighters, great punching power, but Silva, as you mentioned last week, is a black belt in jiu-jitsu, and he manhandled him. I mean, this was no contest. Should they have tried to protect Houston Alexander a little more to try to build up this star, which clearly everyone is in love with?
Well, I don't know. He came out of nowhere and gave him two great knockouts. I think, you know, they could release him today and be satisfied with what they got out of him. That's pretty good. He finished two fights, both of them dramatically. One against a well-known television star, shocked the world, great buzz for the Ven, great publicity. So in that sense, he delivered a whole lot. They said him a guy who's a jiu-jitsu black belt, not a wrestling phenom, but, I mean, he passed Alexander's guard like it wasn't even there. I mean, knee cut across, pass, bang. Like, that is day two jiu-jitsu. And he wiped the floor with him. To say whether he's worth it or not is strictly a matter of balancing what they want out of him versus how many fights left on his contract. I believe he has a decent deal. He signed for more fights. You know, if that's the case and they have to keep putting him out there, then they're probably going to be in trouble because, he didn't get exposed in the sense that, oh, everyone suddenly knew about his ground game. He got exposed in the sense that, okay, how bad is his ground game? It's pretty bad off his back. He can be dominated very easily by top wrestlers at that weight class. I would think, as big and as strong as he is. Did they make a mistake in hiring him? I don't think so. The question is, what does it do with Silva? Because Silva is still, in many ways, untested. All we really know about Silva is that he can beat tough guys standing, and he's got relatively good jiu-jitsu. But Alexander, I keep telling people, there are unknown commodities in MMA. There's a lot of them going around. Kimbo Slice, Brock Lesnar. Until you see them tested and at difficult intervals, beating up guys, beating up easy guys tells you nothing. They have to beat up tough guys. They have to get hurt. They have to persevere, and they have to demonstrate technique. And until you do that, signing on to their abilities is a bad idea. Always err on the side of doubt in MMA. And I think that's it sounds cruel, but that's the place you really want to be. Alexander will be back, but he's 35 years old. How much time does he really have to learn a lot of jiu-jitsu to improve his game and still be competitive in a reasonable athletic window? I think that's drawing to a close. So this kind of blew up in their faces a little bit, but he did deliver two knockouts, and that's noteworthy.
Speaking of tough guys, Karl Parisian defeated Rio Chonin via unanimous decision. And again, sitting where I was bored by this fight. I mean, it was another case of Karl Parisian just kind of doing exactly what he needed to do to win, but boring. I mean, yeah, give the guy credit. He definitely beat a great fighter in Rio Chonin making his UFC debut, but I just saw nothing from Cairo where I would want to see him actually, you know, go up against one of the top welterweights, whether it's Hughes, Serra, St. Pierre, whoever, in a fight, because he just, you know, just does just enough to win, but it's just, to me, boring. What did you make of Cairo Parisian's performance against Chonin?
I would say that Cairo Parisian, I would agree with most of what you're saying. Cairo Parisian seems to have caught the same disease that grabbed Tim Sylvia, where, you know, Sylvia actually had a war gold around his waist, but Cairo got very close. He got a title shot offered to him against Matt Hughes, had the quadricep injury 2 years ago and had to pull out. I think he's fighting conservatively because he needs the W. At the end of the day, how does he get from where he is at this very day to a title shot? It's not by losing. It's not by losing and putting on exciting fights. That is not going to get him a title shot. So if he fights conservatively, it should not be a surprise. The only way he's going to get there is by getting the W, and that's going to keep him safe. They can deny him a title shot with W's, but they can always deny him a title shot with a loss. So he has to win. But what I would say, though, that, I don't know, I think from a technical standpoint, that fight is a little bit underappreciated. There were a lot of cool things going on from a technical standpoint, and I guess if you never trained or didn't train, if you didn't have the benefit of having someone demonstrate technique to you, you know, some of the stuff they were doing in that fight was defensive, but it was high-level defense, and that, for me, created suspense throughout the fight. And particularly one thing that Carr was doing, just as an example I thought was great, was he never let Rio Chonin kick him without being able to grab his leg, and Chonin wasn't telegraphing his kicks. There was something in the way he was throwing them in either combinations or how he was setting them up that Cairo was keyed in on. Cairo must have watched tape and got it. Just about every time he kicked, he grabbed the leg. That's something that's very, very difficult to do. And Cairo did it with ease. I was very surprised at that. That is a hard thing to do. So Cairo's still got all the talent, but until they give him a title shot, until he scratches that itch, he's going to be fighting conservatively. I think they need to give him a title shot sooner rather than later so that he wins the title and now he's the champion, or he loses it and he doesn't have to constantly think, well, I'm going to have to get right back to that title shot. Maybe he can throw down a little bit more and then I think, once again, in this case, maximize his potential. Cairo is best when he is able to be the aggressor and he is yet still in control. And right now he either flames too far to one side, and I think once he manages to find the right balance, that's what he'll do. I just think he needs to get that monkey off his back. Until we see that, we're going to see defensive Cairo.
Well, more to that point, when you bring that up, I think of Andrei Arlovsky against Fabricio Werdum at UFC 70. And before that fight, Dana White had said the winner of this one will probably get a title shot quite soon, perhaps after Couture Gonzaga, which was supposed to be Couture against Krokop. But now, you know, Andrei Arlovsky is MIA. No one knows where he is. And Dana White was very vocal in saying, you can't just do enough to win. I want to see exciting fights. So is that the right approach to take for Cairo Parisian?
Again, what's the alternative? So he fights John Fitch, and he did like he did against Sanchez, and he throws Fitch 5-6 times. Beautiful Uchimadas, beautiful Hirayagoshis throwing the guy. And then landing his side mount. And then what does Fitch do? He turns over on his base, takes his back, snatches Cairo off his base, and so Cairo has to defend the rear naked choke, right? Flashy, great for a fight. These judo throws in MMA, guys can take your back really easily. That's one of the tricks. It's one of the reasons why Cairo didn't throw Chonin a lot more than he could have. One is Chonin defended it, but two, Chonin knows the first thing you do when someone throws you like that, go for the back. Where is that going to get Cairo? That's not going to get him a title shot. This is MMA 2.0. Okay, so title shots and big time fights, they matter now. Then there's import to them. You can't just if you want to be the kind of guy who puts on exciting fights and loses, that means you've accepted losing into your overall career game plan. You have to accept losses, but you don't have to elect to make them a comfortable component of your career. I think Cairo still wants to prove he's the best in the world. And a UFC title shot is a meaningful thing. There's money, attention, all kinds of other opportunities that it brings. And in the welterweight division, that's arguably the most stacked MMA division in the world, period. So for him to fight conservatively, I don't know what people expect otherwise. He's damaged goods. He had a title shot. It was yanked. This is how he's going to fight until he either wins the title or loses a title shot. I really believe that we're never going to get a Caro. You know, we'll get moments of brilliance, but we're never going to get a Caro unless he absolutely hates the guy, throws caution to the wind, until a title shot picture is presented to him. And I just think people need to get accustomed to that.
All right. Well, the UFC announced after the show that the fight of the night was Chris Liddell against Thiago Silva, and you were actually really high on this matchup going in, looking forward to it very much. So, unfortunately, we didn't get a nice resolution to the fight because of a cut on top of Lytle's eye. And, you know, this brings up the question about elbows, you know, and those cuts that they create and not getting a clear winner, especially in a great fight like this one. I wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, the fight in itself, and also what's your take on elbows in MMA? Do you subscribe to the Bas Rutten thought process that they should be totally outlawed as they are in the IFL?
I'll go with the second part first. I think elbows should be allowed. I think if I admit that when a fighter loses because of elbows, which bring up a lot of, you know, people don't know at home, but the elbows cut people's faces very easily, or it's comparatively easy. Sometimes they can come in very big ways. Do I think that is it unfortunate if a fight is stopped to a cut every time? Not just from elbows, but from kicks, knees. You know, Marvin Eastman has one of the worst cuts ever. He didn't get it from an elbow. He got it from a knee. So any time a fight like that is stopped because the guy can go on, but he can't see because of you know, cuts, KJ Nunes, Nick Diaz, that's unfortunate. But that is an occupational hazard. This is fighting, and you know, I hate to use the Donald Rumsfeld of logic, but you come to the fight with the fighter who you are. And, you know, if your face is full of scar tissue, then that's sort of the trade-off you have to make. I don't know. I know that elbows cut people a lot. I think that's because people throw them. They're not that good at throwing them. You're starting to see more guys who throw elbows standing. You're starting to see a lot more guys get better at defending elbows. I think there was a while there where guys were getting cut up a lot. You know, David Loazzo showed that, you know, elbows can be, we knew before that, but he really popularized the use of elbows. But we're seeing guys get better about it now, and I have the philosophy that if you get hit by an elbow, stop getting hit with an elbow. If you're stuck in side mount on your back and you can't get out, then find a way out. That's how it works in training. That's how they tell you in training to get better. You know, if you're stuck on the bottom, find a way to get out, because no one's going to give you a way out. Yeah, they stand guys up in fights, but that's the idea you have to have. You have to know how to counter everything that comes your way. And if you can't stop an elbow, then maybe you shouldn't be competing in high-level professional mixed martial arts. If you have a lot of scar tissue, then maybe you should get some better defense. That's kind of the way of the world. Obviously, there are some precautions you want to take, but I don't think elbows are ending so many fights in this epidemic kind of way that it involves changing the rules, especially when you can knock a guy out standing with elbows, and the Thais do it regularly because they throw them well. Jorge Masvidal just knocked out Matt Lee and Playboy Mansion with inline standing elbows. This is not an uncommon thing. I think just once guys get better at it and guys get better at defense off their back, this won't be so much of an issue. And as it relates to the fight, Lytle Alves, I'll just briefly say, great fight. Surprisingly, Alves got overwhelmed in the first round, but came back with brutal leg kicks. And apparently, you know, the crowd there was getting behind it as well and was very upset when Lytle got pulled out. You know, I can't say I called it because I had a hunch that it was going to go this direction, and it did. It's just a shame. It's a shame for Chris Lotto because he always seems to come up on the short end of the stick, even when he puts in a lot. But the UFC knows that guy will always come to fight. He's very talented, very well-rounded, and he is the difference between a Carl Parisian. Chris Lotto will probably never be a welterweight champion. Probably. Carl Parisian has a good shot at it, and they're at different points in their careers. Chris Lotto can get away with being exciting and losing. Carl Parisian does not want that level. I think he wants another level, and that's the distinction between those two.
Lots of expectations surrounding Frankie Edgar and Spencer Fisher, especially since they're coming off potential matches of the year. Did you think that their battle won by Frankie Edgar, did you think that it lived up to the hype?
No, it didn't. But, you know, in fairness, I should have seen that one coming, too. I should have seen that. Here's what I thought was going to happen differently. And other people can say, I thought that one, maybe Spencer Fisher would catch him standing enough to hurt him to make it compelling, if not stop him. Or I thought Fisher was going to offer enough off of his back to make to help neutralize some of Edgar's wrestling. But that didn't really happen. Turns out that on the feet, you know, it wasn't a whole lot to say one way or the other. Obviously, both guys looked pretty competent. On the ground, though, Edgar would pass a little bit and then Spencer Fisher would just sort of knee cut across to get back inside. That was all that was really going on off the back. I mean, it wasn't a whole lot. Obviously, Edgar's got a really good takedown. He showed it. As far as what Edgar has to offer, people are going to call me crazy, but I'm still a little bit not sold on him. He beat Tyson Griffin. That's great. He beat Davidus Torres Vesius, which I've always said is his best win. And he just beat Spencer Fisher. That's a hell of an accomplishment. But as good of a wrestler as Tyson Griffin is, I just feel like somebody like, granted he's not in the UFC, but I feel like somebody like a Brandon Melendez would eat Edgar's lunch. I just think he's got all the answers, no pun intended, for Frankie Edgar. As far as in the UFC, how would it go? Edgar is, you know, how's he going up against just a freight train like Sean Sherk? Edgar's a better wrestler, but who's got better cardio? You think Edgar's got better cardio than Sean Sherk? Not a chance in hell. How's he deal with Joe Stevenson, a guy who is also a really good wrestler and a much better submission wrestler? So is Tyson Griffin, but I think that Joe Daddy is better than both of them. So I think he's clearly an up-and-coming, very, very promising talent. Huge win for him. But, you know, I said it before, until somebody tests him, someone needs to hurt him. And I know Griffin did that, but I wonder if Griffin was a little bit shocked by what he was getting into. You know, he came in, Edgar did, kind of unheralded. So now we know he's a bit of a more known commodity. Let's see someone in the upper tier, really, really upper tier, handle him or take him on. And then, depending on how he does there against the guy with a similar skill set of wrestling and striking, then I'll be able to say confidently. But maybe, you know, a win over somebody like that, he could be in line for a title shot, definitely.
All right, and coming out of the press conference, Dana White announced that Dan Henderson finally agrees to move down to challenge Anderson Silva for his middleweight title. It seemed as though Henderson was very reluctant to do so. He had said so publicly. Do you think that this fight is going to be billed as a unification bout, or has pride just completely been forgotten now, erased from the history books?
Yeah, good question. I am going to guess that they're not going to worry about pride unification anymore. I think what they will, because first of all, there are different weight classes. At least with 205 pounds, they were both 205. In pride, their welterweight, which is what our middleweight is 183. Granted, it's only 2 pound difference, but it is a difference. But what I would say is that I think they had the unification thing, so to speak, to bury pride when Henderson fought Jackson. I don't know that they'll do it again. They'll mention that the end of that thing, but I don't know that they'll call it a unification bout between titles. As far as predictions go, I have been begging for this fight. I have seen only fleeting glimpses of Anderson Silva's weaknesses, but what I have seen lead me to believe that Dan Henderson can definitely, definitely, definitely beat Anderson Silva. In fact, at this early juncture, provided there isn't something that happens from here until that day, I do believe that Dan Henderson will be your new UFC middleweight champion. I will go on the record very early of saying that. I think he has the skill set to beat him. He's very tough. He can easily wrestle someone to the ground. And once there, he's good enough on the ground, both in terms of guard passing and ground to pound, to if not stop Silva, which no one has been able to do except for Chonin's heel hook. If certainly not stop him, certainly beat him up enough to take him out of his game and take his title over the course of 5 rounds. And, you know, Anderson Silva is a dangerous guy, but the way he responded, even with the knee problems, to Travis Luter's attacks and the other guys good on the ground, leads me to believe that, you know, he beat Alexander Otsuka, but Otsuka held him down. And Otsuka isn't half the wrestler or the fighter that Dan Henderson is. I think this is a match Dan Henderson can definitely win. I don't think Silva will knock him out. I think he'll probably hurt him, and that's about it. I'd be shocked if Silva knocked him out. So I think you're going to see, by the time the evening of UFC 82, I think you're going to see a brand new middleweight champion.
Wow. I'm also curious to know your thoughts on a good friend of Dan Henderson's, Randy Couture. He was in Kyle Parisian's corner, and I'm not really sure what to make of that. I wasn't expecting Couture to be seen at any UFC event, especially since you know, his quote-unquote divorce with them is so fresh in the minds of everyone. And there he was with his hat kind of low, covering his eyes, but he certainly was there in Newark. Do you view this as a positive sign that the whole Randy versus Dana feud will be resolved positively, you know, in the next coming days or weeks or months?
Yes, but I don't know that his appearance in Carl's Corner has much to do with that. I mean, I doubt the UFC would actually ban Randy. No, they never said they were mad at him per se. They always sort of the line from Zuffa and from Dana White was their hands in the air, palms up, being like, we don't really know what's going on. Never that Randy Couture was a bad guy. So the other thing to keep in mind is back when this first started going on, there were talks on the inside. I have some friends, really sort of associates on the inside, who were telling me that they've been trying to work this thing out together privately for a long time now. And it's finally come to a point now where after the back and forth and the little pissing contest, it seems like that might be over. I do believe there's hope for reconciliation. Whether there'll be ever a Fedor Randy Couture fight, I doubt it. But certainly a Fedor Nogueira fight, Couture Nogueira fight, which I think Couture would take away quite easily. In any event, I think that the possibilities of this being resolved amicably are good. What that means for fighters, you know, it was so great when Randy Couture left, because now fighters can, the big time ones can sort of assert their control, and Fedor's with M1. And if Randy goes back, you know, what does that do for fighters having a little bit of status outside the organization by being to compete with the organizational power and marketing and pull with respect to your career? So, you know, positively, it can be resolved amicably, but I'm always a little nervous about how these things play themselves out in terms of perception and what it does to the MMA industry.
Finally, you bring up Fedor, and your site, BloodyEbel.com, is reporting that we might see the great Fedor facing Hongman Choi on New Year's Eve. The last time American fans heard of Hongman Choi, they might remember him, that he was supposed to face Brock Lesnar, fell through, and now perhaps he could be the opponent, the long-awaited opponent for Fedor. How close is that deal to being signed?
It's not that close. It's certainly being rumored, but, you know, I hope it's not very close, because, my God, you want to talk about deeply disappointing? I mean, it doesn't get any more disappointing than that. Fedor fighting Hongman Choi. This guy couldn't get cleared in America because he had pituitary problems. This is what Fedor couldn't sign with the UFC for. This is what being in Russia and fighting Sambo and helping out the Red Devil Fight Team, that's how much they mean to him, because he passed up on greatness and fighting the best for that. So that tells you how much that meant to him. No wonder Dana couldn't throw a price tag at him. I mean, it's a pathetic match. It's pathetic matchmaking. It's pathetic. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. It is truly, truly bottom of the barrel. Not to say that Fedor's going to wipe the floor with him, just more of a who cares. This match, for those folks who don't know, the Japanese are into this kind of freak show mismatch, giants versus heroes, David versus Goliath, you know, freak show versus oddity kind of matchups. They're into this thing. They have a very pro-wrestling attitude towards combat athletics and mixed martial arts, and that's what you're seeing play out here partly. But, I mean, my God, Hongman Choi, I had zero desire to watch Fedor fight this guy. Josh Barnett will not have fought at once in 2007, if you can possibly believe that. I cannot believe he has been able to not get a decent contract on his way or sign somebody on the dotted line for a fight that could easily happen. It's just a travesty. And if, you know, this is the way Fedor wants to end his career, obviously it's his perspective, and I'm hoping he gets what he's looking for. But as a fan and as someone who talks about the sport on a daily basis, the news couldn't be any more pathetic.
Okay, so clearly you're not interested in seeing Hongman Choi go up against Fedor. So at this point, who would you love to see Fedor go up against? Would it be Josh Barnett?
Well, I think Josh Barnett would be an interesting choice, and it'd be a fun choice, and it'd be a meaningful fight. But, my whole philosophy in this matter is that the problem with the Hongman Choi fight is that it's such an unnecessary, deviantly off, you know, widely off the course of anything that's remotely approximating a career path in terms of how he wants to finish in his 30s here. Fedor ostensibly has a lot of fight left in him, and my whole thing is, you know, it doesn't have to be his first fight back. Fedor hasn't fought in a year, so his first fight back doesn't have to be right away Josh Barnett. maybe he could take another fight that would be a little bit of still a stiff test, still a stiff challenge, but more so something that will resemble a future heavyweight fight down the road. What is the fight with Hong Man Choi? What similarities does that have to anybody in the heavyweight division? And I've put this out before, but I would just say, strictly speaking, what about a fight with Melvin Manhoff? You know, here's another guy in K1 that can, do work with them through M1. Amazing Dutch striker. I think once the fight went to the ground, it would be fatal all day. But at least that fight would have some kind of, rough similarity to a future heavyweight fight. It's still more of a traditional fight than fighting Shrek. I don't know. That's strictly a matter of people looking for. That's the Japanese way of looking for, a tough man contest. Just this weird, chaotic brawl that they get off on, this sort of theater that they like about fights. It's not my favorite kind of thing. They get off on it, great, happy for them, but it doesn't work for me. And it's sad that this is what Fedor wanted, this is what Fedor gave up the Red Devil and whatnot for, that is what he gave the UFC contract for. And it's a bit of a shame, but he has his priorities and fans have his. I just think that this is really pathetic matchmaking, I just feel that there are a variety of other guys he could fight as a good first start back, and it doesn't have to be a guy in this, above 7 feet tall and this, beast.
As always, great stuff from Luke Thomas. I really want to thank you for joining us again here on JerryPark.com. And I still have so much to ask you, but we'll save it for another time. BloodyElbow.com, you can read all his great material and his whole team over there. Unbelievable stuff. And I appreciate you taking the time. Please join us again.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.